Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00025. Recorded on March 2, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Above it all. Above it all. Chapter 25.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Okay, first and foremost, I want to wish you all a very happy Texas Independence Day. Yes, Texas Independence Day. That's a thing. That is a thing in Texas. Texas Independence Day. So for all you Texans out there and all you wannabe Texans out there and all you utopians fantasizing about coming to Texas, happy Texas Independence Day. And we're kind of battening down the hatches here in Texas as things are at the moment. We have what appears to be incoming tornadoes and hail. It's the season, right? Springtime. Really the transitional season, spring and fall. But it seems to be worse in the spring, right? What we have is the battle between summer and winter. And in that process, there's collateral damage. And it comes in the way of hailstorms and tornadoes and sometimes both. They're not mutually exclusive. Frequently they go hand in hand. In 2016, in Wylie, Texas, and I was living there at the time, I got caught in it. We had a hailstorm where it lasted like 22, 23 minutes, and we had hail coming down the size of softballs. Yeah. The little hail was like baseballs and shit. The big hail was coming down like softballs. It was literally going through the roof. You know, it went through the roof. The roofing shingles, the tar paper went through the fucking plywood, right? Down through the rafters, through the fucking sheetrock, into the kitchen, landing on the kitchen floor of your house. It was brutal. It was a beatdown, right? I mean, and that happens down here. It happens every year somewhere in North Texas. A lot of times it happens out in the wide open, out in the field somewhere. That particular year it happened right on this city. I mean, the entire city and nowhere else. Just right here, right in Wylie, Texas, and nowhere else. That was horrible. It was horrible. But, you know, hey, springtime and We're looking for around like dinner time tonight to start getting a couple of lines of actually it's odd patches of bursts of storms that's followed by a line, right? So it's really unstable shit coming through. So there's a lot of talk about the devastating potential of it all. So we got to keep an eye on it. Other early signs of spring, right? It's starting to pop up. I mean, what you got to understand here, all right? It's right at the beginning of March. In Texas, we're already pretty much 2 weeks into spring. Our springtime begins usually like Valentine's Day, right? It starts warming up. We've already had temperatures approaching 90. I think we hit 90 one day already in February. I mean, it's for real. This happens. The telltale sign, right, the one slam dunk, when you see it, you know it's spring and it ain't going to be winter no more, is when the daffodils bloom, right? The yellow daffodils bloom up. And I got a line of them here at work. And they got green, they're growing tall, they're healthy, but they're not blooming yet. So there might be a little cold jag yet to be had. It might just be a day, something passing through. But somehow these fucking flowers, they know they will not come out until winter is absolutely gone. Other signs of spring, however, right? We got the skeeter eaters. Right? They look like giant mosquitoes, but they're not actually mosquitoes, and they're all over the place, right? When they come out, They're everywhere. We call them skeeter eaters down here. They go by other names like mosquito hawk. What they are crane flies, right? You know, like the bird, you got that large bird they call a crane. This is like the fly version. It's like, it's a large fly. It's kind of lanky and clumsy, slow. It's like a crane in a lot of ways, but that's what they're called, crane flies. We call them skeeter eaters. So they're around. When you start seeing them around, spring is opening up. Also, and like it is everywhere else in the country, you got the robin redbreast, right? The robin with the orange feathers on its bottom side, its chest and everything. Seen a couple of those already within the past couple of weeks. So there's your telltale sign also. The first trees that start to bloom are going to be, and they are, we've seen them already, cherry blossoms, right? The cherry blossoms. I go all the way back with cherry blossoms. In fact, I was a little guy, right? I come from Newark, New Jersey originally. And the last place that I lived in Newark was literally on Branch Brook Park, right? In the North Ward, the old Italian section. I could throw a fucking baseball and hit the park. I was like two houses in from it, right? And in that Branch Brook Park, they have a section that's all these cherry blossoms. So when spring happens up there, like in fucking June or July, it happens down here in February, but it happens up there way later. Yeah, really more like March, right? I would say April, you probably start seeing that kind of stuff. Depends on the precipitation. They get heavy rain in the spring. But anyway, whatever. They got the cherry blossoms up in Branch Brook Park, and it's kind of a big deal. If you're from North Jersey, you know about that. You see, you just kind of drive through the park. Oh, the cherry blossoms. And they really are gorgeous when you get a whole lot of them together. Obviously, Washington, D.C. is famous for the cherry blossoms down there, but fuck D.C. I feel like I need to go take a shower just by saying it. What a filthy, sleazy fucking place. I can't stand the federal government. Bunch of scumbags. Moving on from that. One place, nobody talks about this, but when I was driving the truck back in the day, I remember I was doing a lot of Appalachian riding, right? I-75, I-81, I-95, up and down, from New Jersey down to Georgia, up into like Ohio and Michigan and everything in between, right? Virginia and Maryland and West Virginia and the Carolinas. Excuse me, I'm getting a little croaky here for some reason. Let me get a sip of coffee. Alright. But I remember this one particular time. Now, I was heading south down 75 through Kentucky. And somewhere way down in the bottom of Kentucky, there was this hillside that was just cherry blossoms, like top to bottom. It was one of the most fantastic psychedelic things I ever saw, right? And I was just like, and I didn't know what the fuck I was looking at. You know, for somebody like who had cherry blossoms in their background, there was just so many of them stacked up on top of each other. It's like it didn't register with me, you know, like it's some kind of wild thing. But down in the South, they just kind of grow wherever they happen to grow, right? They're not necessarily like landscaped, arborist planted type of stuff. And I got the snapshot in my head. I just like trucking down I-75 in Kentucky and seeing that, right? And then you start climbing up. You know, you're on the like edge of the Appalachians over there, Appalachians. When you cross the border, like right after that, you cross the border into Tennessee and you're like on top of this ridge, right? Another fascinating site. It's like a really cool, like hour or less, right? In the springtime, heading south out of Kentucky, you get into the Tennessee, you cross the line, and then you find yourself on top of this ridge, and you could like see off, like in the distance, looking out to the south and west, like the west and south, southwest. It bends, you know, it's heading north and south, and it kind of bends back to the east, and somewhere right around that bend, it's like the rest of the nation just opens up. Yeah, and you're like way up in the sky looking down on everything. You're like above all of it. You're above it all. You just get that sense of height and I don't even know how to put it into words, but clearly you are above it all. Which brings me to the fiction story du jour, right? I mentioned a couple of episodes back where I had remarkably, miraculously come across some old files that I thought were long gone that were the beginning chapters of a book, a fiction novel I was starting to write, 15, 16 years ago. Yeah, right around the same time where that whole Kentucky cherry blossom thing happened, right? In those same kind of days. And, this is the second edition where I'm going to read from one of those files, one of those chapters. And this chapter is actually called Above It All. It's not exactly sitting on the precipice of Appalachian Mountains, but you're still high above it, and you'll get the idea when I start to read into it. So let me do that without any further ado. Let me go dig that up. Where the hell is it? I'm going to put it in my... right here, perhaps. Probably should have prepared. All right, here it is. I got it. It's in my email. All right. And I don't like doing this part, okay? I'm doing this because I'm thinking that you all might like it. Right, so I'm doing it for you. It's a gift. It's a gift. This one's short, though. This one's short. So we'll do a little bit more monologics than reading stories today. last time it was like, I don't know, 12 minutes of reading or some shit like that. This time, all right, the chapter 2, Above It All. Here we go. High above the city, a little bird stood on a balcony rail in the darkness some 20 floors above the light and buzz of the streets. Below, the bright of the streets struggled through the tree-lined ways to the open skies. Out yonder, out in the southerly evening panorama of the big town, a colorful spread of what was truly a dense green suburbia, pricked with a handful of high-rise buildings laid out into the distance. The main drag ran brightly into and through the downtown area like a thick artery of a little heart. The heart, the downtown, was most city-like, most gem-like, very bright, very concrete, very glassy, and quite tall. The sprawl around it was much less so, but it hopped and bopped with life, mostly loud music, mostly from cruising automobiles, yet with the occasional hollering of a drunken playfulness outside the clubs. A large freeway ran through the middle of it all, coursing a stream of red light southbound into the far-off distance where jetliners ascended and descended continuously. Across the freeway lay the darker, flatter, and dirtier sections of the old pre-industrial city. Above it all, the night sky was city orange-black, and only the brightest of stars shined through. The bird turned on its little pink legs and twinkled. It peered through the slats of burgundy vertical blinds dangling inside the sliding glass balcony door. There on the floor, a frail man in a white robe sat with his legs drawn fetal, arms wrapped around bony knees, buttocks and thin heels pressed into a burgundy mat atop a white carpet, right shoulder pressed up against the cool glass of the door. He dangled a cell phone loosely in the long fingers of his left hand. His head was tilted downward and his face was hollow, with cold blue eyes staring somehow emptily and yet bitterly into some nothingness before him. He bobbed slowly in dry, quiet tears, gently shifting the longest strands of his dirty blonde hairs to and fro across his angular, elfish chin. The room was lit in red candlelight and was sparse in arrangement. A flat-panel television was set high on the wall behind him. Tall, potted plants stood in three corners, and a glass coffee table sat in the middle of the room before a white couch and love seat. A small scattering of clothing was spread across the floor on the far side of the room, strewn with a pair of sandals and a pair of flip-flops. On the coffee table, a single red dinner candle with a long, wavering dash of flame stood tall in a crystal base above a pair of silk panties and a corkscrew. A gold credit card was laid atop a small square hand mirror beside a pinch of white powder. A crystal goblet with nary a nose of pink wine shimmered in the candlelight. Another one lay tipped over and spilled. A bottle of Zinfandel, also on its side, bled drips of pink through white lacy napery, pooling across the tabletop. A single breach cried little pink tears down to a growing spot on the plush white carpet. There on the carpet, propped up against a table leg, teetered a stone sculpture. It was a Moai replica, a scaled-down hand carving of a long stone face. Blood ran down from its temple into and out of its left eye and streaming a single streak down its left cheek. On the couch sat a motionless, tight little Latino man, set deep into fluffy white cushions. His eyes were closed, his mouth was draped open, and his head was tilted to one side. His left arm hung loosely across his abdomen, and his hand twisted, screwballed across his right hip bone. He was naked but for a blue beaded necklace and a white gold anklet, and his flesh shimmered with the candlelight. He sat perfectly still but for a thick streak of blood ranging across his cheek. And not unlike the Moai sculpture, it bled out from his left temple. Only on the man, it welled through tight, polished waves of short, glossy black hair. On the couch, laid back deeply into the cushions, sat this tight little man. He was naked, he was bleeding, he was flaccid, and he was dead. The man in the white robe shook the ghosts from his head, wildly tossing his locks about side to side, and exhaled deeply. His whole body walked in a long, chill shiver, and he dropped his hamstrings flat to the floor. He held the phone up before him and stared at the dim LCD. He smeared a whispery giggle and flipped the phone open. His face lit up electric blue in the glow of the keypad, and he plugged away at the buttons with his thumb. He drew the phone to his face, up underneath his dangling blonde hair, and to his ear. After a moment, he began to speak into the phone. The little bird turned and scattered from the balcony, flying off over the city, swooping down into the warm orange buzz. It flew along the main drag above the passing cars and bent eastward before a downtown area. It disappeared behind an apartment terrace and sailed off into the sprawl. So in that story, there we had that little stone sculpture that had the trickling teardrop of blood running down the side. It was used as a clobbering tool in a murder of that tight little Latino man sitting naked on the couch, right? Maybe, I'm sure some of you out there know exactly what a Moai statue is. Probably some of you don't. This is what it is, all right? It's a mysterious, monolithic human figure carved by the Rapa Nui people on Easter Island, right? In eastern Polynesia, between the years of 1250 and 1500. They're big, rectangular, monolithic hunks of rock that have big, long, somber faces carved into them, right? And they're on this kind of desolate island, and it's thought to be mysterious how they got there, how they were carved, who did it, how they moved the stone around, you know, all that kind of quote-unquote mysterious stuff. And you know, it's the kind of shit that you would see, like, I bring it up from time to time, those television series and movies from the 70s, right? You had In Search Of. A sequence of three movies, I think, with Rod Serling, the Twilight Zone guy. And then the concept was brought forward in a television format where your narrator was Leonard Nimoy, right? The guy who played Spock in Star Trek, the original series, the Vulcan. So throughout the 70s, you kind of had this whole line of ancient mystery television, which kind of picked up and started again in the late 90s and through the 2000s. They started doing things on the History Channel, like Ancient Aliens and shit like that, right? They're all the same thing. It's a whole same line, just different, a whole same line of thought from different generations, and really done in the same manner, right? But one of those things, you know, was always like they, In Search Of Easter Island mysteries, and, you know, but there was, you know, When I say mysteries, I mean things like Bermuda Triangle. You ever hear of the Bermuda Triangle? I'll talk about the Bermuda Triangle. Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, UFOs and aliens, ancient astronauts, like I mentioned, right? So it's in search of this, in search of that. And the idea is like that everything we're searching for has some kind of element of mystery to it. Unsolved mystery is probably the best way to put it, and then posing potential answers to the questions that are raised by the mystery. That's the premise of it all, right? That's the premise of it all. So you have mysteries like the Eastern Island mystery and the Bermuda Triangle mystery and the Loch Ness Monster mystery and the Bigfoot mystery and the UFOs and the aliens, mysteries, and all the things I mentioned, right? Now, the Bermuda Triangle mystery, I said I'd get back to that. That's where you have this, I guess, what they posited was this uncanny amount of disappearing ships and airplanes that happened over a certain sector of the Atlantic Ocean, which is known as the Bermuda Triangle. That is, on your map, a triangle drawn from the points of Miami, Florida, out to the Bahamas, and then up to Bermuda, back to Florida, right? So you get this triangle out there. And the mystery is, what causes all of these vessels to disappear in this one particular area, right? So, and this is what happens with these mystery shows. These in search of mystery shows, they all kind of operate in the same manner, right? Not kind of, they do. They do. Basically, what's going on is they present to you an unsolved mystery. They show some kind of data that draws the picture of the mystery for you, you know, instances that occurred, like the Bermuda Triangle example. This ship with these men on this date went out and they crossed the Bermuda Triangle and they were not heard from since. And then there was this airplane that went out at this time and this date and they had all these people on board and it flew across the Bermuda Triangle and nobody has heard from it since. And you know, that kind of stuff, they draw the picture, you know. They announce the mystery. They give you examples of what makes the mystery mysterious. It's always got that unsolved edge to it. And then you'll get a couple of guys, just the random people that they bring in as some kind of subject matter expert. But they it turns out that they're not, right? They're just a couple of hacks that are just questioning all this stuff. And, you know, They'll posit their own theories as to what may be going on. Maybe there's some magnetic force under the sea. Maybe it's an angry fucking Greek god. And whatever, you know, whatever ideas these people can have to show, like, alternate theories on what may be causing this sort of thing. And then they'll bring an actual, like, subject matter expert in this line. And they'll let you know, you know. Here's he's got a PhD from this college and, you know, he's a meteorologist or he's like a rear admiral in the fucking Coast Guard. You know, he's somebody who really ought to know. And what does he always say? Well, unfortunately, we don't have answers to what's going on at this point in time. Right? So the experts don't know. But all these other guys with all these alternate theories, they know. So they'll follow up the expert again with these hacks, and the hacks will turn their questions, right? There's a question in the mystery, then they raise these theories which are really questions, and then they bring them back again as answers, even though there was no answer. Because there was no answer from the expert, now their questions become answers. Is it an angry Greek god in the sky? It appears to be so, right? You know, and that's where it goes. That's where all these shows go. And so whatever they want you to believe, they just kind of shove you in that direction, right? And there's some people, you know, viewers who are more susceptible to that sort of thing than others. And let me tell you, I was one of them. I was a sucker for that shit, right? Always was, always will be. And the reason why is, hey, it's a youthful vulnerability, right? Just being young in general makes you vulnerable. And that's why it's very important for adults to let the kids play with the kids, right? Let kids do kids' things and don't infiltrate their learning zone so much. I've spoken about that sort of thing before, you know, like where it comes to sex and everything and pedophilia, you know, adults dating and having sex with children, you know, that kind of stuff. But not just in a physical manner, all kinds of manners, right? These kind of theories, these kind of questions, these kind of doubts in these mystery, unsolved mystery type of shows, that's really ultimately adult content. That is really something that parents need to sit with the children and explain. It's not too much for a child to understand what these people are saying, but it is too much for a child to understand what these people are doing. Okay, what they're doing, it is a form of like psychic pedophilic butt rape, as far as I'm concerned. That's a little serious, and I get if you kind of squirm at that idea. But let me tell you my rationale, right? Like I said, I was susceptible to this sort of thing, and there's a reason why. And really, I think we all are as adolescents, because there's something that happens in adolescence that makes us susceptible to it. And that is the idea, I call it an instinctual rebellion, right? And what do I mean by that? It's part of our natural composition to start questioning things when we get into adolescence. What I believe is that we go to that point in our lives learning so much about the how of things, right? Kids copy, they parrot. They hear something, they repeat it. They see something, they do it, right? We learn the how of stuff. We learn how to lie. We learn how to get along. We learn how to be nice. We learn how to share. All these things add up to like getting along well with others. Of course, I was challenged in that regard, but I had my moments too, right? But the whole thing was the how of it. And when you start getting into your teenage years, now it starts to turn into the why of it, right? We start to turn into the why. We start to question things. And I think it's proper. I think it's part of our maturing process to begin to question things. Because what's happening there is now we question them. Hopefully we find the answers. When we find the answers, we have found the answers for ourselves. We didn't just take somebody's word for it. We put human knowledge to the test and had our questions answered, but by our own testing of it, right? Did I say that well enough? Right. We tried the information handed to us and found it to be right or wrong, but we know for ourselves. We're not just taking it anymore for as given. It's tried and true as a result of our own efforts. And this is what we do through our adolescence heading into adulthood. We take what we were given and we put it to the test, and the test proves it out. It becomes legitimate information that we can hang our hat on and believe in, right? So it's a natural process, instinctual rebellion. We are rebelling against the authorities that are handing us all this information, because we have to understand it for ourselves. Now, that comes in a variety of degrees, right? Some people are more rebellious than others. Some people challenge authority and tradition more than others. I was always that kind of guy, right? I was kind of extreme in these regards. And I think that extremity made me especially susceptible to what was going on with these unsolved mystery types of television programs, as they were back then. And, you know, like the sad thing about it is you're not even believing in answers at that point, right? Those shows would, like I said, you know, they would reveal to you some unsolved mystery. And I say that in quotes, unsolved mystery, because there's a chance that it actually isn't a mystery at all, or it has been solved, right? You know, there's that element too, but you wouldn't know. You're a kid. What the fuck do you know? I never heard of the Bermuda Triangle. What's that? I'm getting all my information from this fucking, turns out to be a shyster, right? Shit. That's how it was, right? It's bullshit. Almost always it's bullshit. But it's presented in a way that it's authoritative, so you just kind of buy it, right? Now, they wouldn't put it on there if it was a lie or anything like bullshit. Of course they would. That's TV. It's exactly what TV does. Anyhow, again, I was susceptible to it because of my proclivity towards rebellion and questioning authority and challenging authority. And, you know, sadly, I went through my teen years and in my early adulthood with a faith base that was rooted in and founded upon believing the questions I'm going to say that again. Believing the questions. What I mean by that is these type of unsolved mysteries raise up questions, and they answer the questions with questions, and the questions become your answer. And you don't have an answer. You just have a question. And that's all I believed in was the questions. I'm going through the world, a world that has no answers. And until this shit is answered, there are no answers. And it becomes like this odd form of nihilism, right? Nihilism. There's just like no truth in anything. There's no reality. Reality sucks. Let me do this. I'll go get a definition for you of nihilism, right? First of all, psychiatrically speaking, right? Psychiatry definition of nihilism is a delusion experienced in some mental disorders that the world or one's mind, body, or self does not exist. All right? And philosophically speaking, a different definition, the doctrine that nothing actually exists or that existence or values are meaningless. And I'll add to that that there's no truth. There's no absolute truth in anything. Right? And now you can see, you know, by those definitions where my thinking as a teenager was already going off in that nihilistic direction, right? Which is something that has become prevalent now in society, right? It's really this kind of idea of, looking at the world around you, deciding it sucks, and not being able to deal with the fact that it sucks. So what do? You start finding a way not to look at the world. You pretend it ain't there, right? That's why people do drugs. I think of the old bumper sticker, right? We had it back in the 80s and 70s. And you may have seen it. You know? Reality is for people that can't handle drugs, right? That was a bumper sticker that we would have put on our cars. We were all on drugs. Wherein the actual saying was, drugs are for people that, can't handle reality. The subject here is reality and our ability or inability, as the case may be, to deal with it. And, there's no question, there's no doubt that reality, what I mean by reality is the world as we know it, what we see. As a person, our world is really people, right? The more people there are in our world, the more fucked up our world is. That's why so many of us want to retreat out to the mountains, right? Go off and lay on a quiet beach by ourselves somewhere to get away from it all. What is the quote-unquote it all? It's the world. It's the world as we know it. The world as we know it that absolutely, definitely, positively, without a shadow of doubt, equal in everybody's mind, sucks, right? It sucks. That's why we have fantasies of utopia. We have all these philosophical ideas about how to make a quote-unquote perfect world, which of course is bullshit, right? My philosophy says the world's supposed to suck, and we're supposed to learn how to get along with it, and then everything that is good and great is to come in the hereafter, right? We'll maybe get into that a little bit later. But when you have come to the place where you realize that this really sucks, and it happens in our adolescence. I'll go back to adolescence again. That's when we start experiencing things like heartbreak, right? We have our first loves, our first girlfriends, our first sex. They cheat on us. Our heart gets broken. There's a breakup. And our worlds are shattered, you know? It's like sometimes on every level, you know, what matters to a kid is how you get along with other kids and where you fit in with the other kids. And you know, your kids are actually more important to you than your own family. You know how it is. It is what it is, right? And everything gets all shooken up, and, you know, you find yourself on the wrong side of everything all of a sudden. And boy, does the world suck. Boy, does reality suck. Boy, is it good just to have a couple of beers and smoke a couple of bones and forget about all that shit, you know? So, yeah, we're going to be either avoiding or ignoring reality or, on the other hand, stepping up and challenging it, challenging authority of reality, challenging the tradition. You know, like I said, we're in that process as adolescents. We're going from childhood to adulthood. In childhood, we got the how of everything. And in adolescence, we get the why. And when we start getting answers on our own answers to the why of it all, then we start to mature into adulthood, right? It's not a matter of numbers, really. It's a matter of answers coming. But I was always the kind to question everything, right? Just, and I still do, to a point. I still do. It's not even to a point. I still do question everything. It's just I've gotten so many answers right now. A lot of my questioning goes up against what I've already actualized, right? I don't have like this empty canvas of experiences, of answers, like I did when I was a teenager. My shit is full. When some ideology is put in front of me, some theology is put in front of me, some philosophy is put in front of me, I've already got something to pair it up against and find it wanting more often than not, right? It's kind of cool to be old in that regard. We do grow up. We do become adult. To me, that's what adulthood is. You know, it's having the wherewithal. It's having the ground to stand on. And it's the ability to take in shit as it comes and filter it out properly and not have your sense of perspective become skewed by bullshit. When we are kids, when we are teenagers, we are very susceptible to that skewing and that bullshit. You know, where did that put me at? You know, when I take on an existence as a young person where my base of faith is basically questions that are pretending to be answers, I don't have any answer in anything at all, right? And all I got is questions, and I just go on questioning everything and challenging everything, and, you know, to the point where I was questioning existence itself, right? The entire creation under God. And then I start to question God, right? But before I get to questioning God, I'll question existence. You know, what does that mean? What does that even mean, questioning existence? Well, in a nihilistic view, am I really here? I'm not really here. I think of a Radiohead song. I'm not here, this isn't happening. What's it, How to Disappear Completely, I think? It's the one about where he's a ghost and he's going up the Liffey and all that. Love that song, I really do, you know. That definitely sets the tone for it. He's like a ghost, I think, in it. But, a nihilistic view is like I'm saying there. It's this thought that the reality isn't even real. I'm not actually even here. There's that element of it, and then there's the other side where, yeah, I'm here, but I don't want to be here. And then the next thought is, fuck it, I'm not going to be here. And that's where I really fell in as a kid, right? If I wasn't stoned or drugged up or something like that, it wasn't really all too easy to be nihilistic. To be stoned, it's easy, because you're already in imagination land, right? You're narcotics. You're not real. You're not present. But when that shit wears off, now you're real and present. You're here. And my natural way of thinking was, well, I want to be stoned again. And if I can't be, I don't want to be here at all. So, if I should ever mention to you about my personal history and my distant past about being a suicidal person, that's where the thinking comes from. And I can actually track that back, that whole line of thought back, right? That line of death, insidious death inside of me back to engaging those unsolved mystery type of fucking shows and the information that came with it, right? That, what did it serve to do? It rattled my foundations. That was the fucking point of it. To take anything that was firm and solid, right? I had a mixed up upbringing. Where it comes to beliefs, I had the atheistic father, right, who fell in with all this Chariot of the Gods bullshit and all these unsolved mystery things. That's how I related with him. On my father's side, you know, my inheritance through him was a religion of that shit. Call it Gnosticism, right? At best, that's what it was. At worst, it was atheism. There's something along those lines, right? Then on my mother's side, I got the Roman Catholicism. And it wasn't all that strict, but there was enough of it there. There was a God, there was a Jesus, there was a Mary and Joseph and John the Baptist, there was all these saints, and there was the priest and the churches and all the religious shit, and you know, but there was, that was a reality also. But between the two of them, I had a very mixed sort of thing. As a kid growing up, I got it moment by moment, and I had a kind of solid foundation, you know, as I managed to assemble it all together. But as I started getting, you know, 10 years old and 11 years old and 12 years old, a lot of what had been settled was starting to get broken up by what? This ranging thought that came with the questioning of everything that had come before, right? And where did I find myself? Broken, unsettled, and fucking suicidal. Go figure, right? Go figure. I take this shit serious, believe me, believe me. I'm always seeking, right? I'm always seeking answers and seeking truth. But I'm not running away from reality. You know, I have no choice. I can't go on drugs anymore. I can't escape. I can't just take a vacation when I want to take a vacation. I'm in it. I'm alive, and I have been for a long time. But yeah, I question it, like, you know, I became a teen, like I was saying, as I got 10, 11, 12, 13, I'm questioning everything, and everything that I had settled was breaking all apart, and like, you know, then I find myself questioning, like, quote-unquote, the church, right? I was only 11 years old when I had my confirmation, right, from Roman Catholicism. I was confirmed, right? The idea is that that's by my own volition. It's supposed to happen when you're 13, but in New Jersey, everybody's busy. The bishop can only come around every 2 or 3 years. That's how it was back then. Some of us got confirmed a little early, right? If it would have waited till I was 13, it would have never happened. I promise you that. It barely happened when I was 11. But it happened, and it happened because I was just doing what I was told. I didn't like it, but I kept showing up. I kept getting in trouble. But there wasn't like hard grading or anything like that. They just kind of shoved you through and, you know, stood by before the bishop and swore you were going to be a good Catholic or whatever the fuck happened that day. I don't remember quite exactly. But the idea was that, you know, on my own volition, I was confirming my faith and my membership in the church, Roman Catholic Church, right? And as soon as that was done, then I was given the option by my mother whether I wanted to go to church or not from that point forward. She did her job, basically. She got me confirmed. Now it's up to me. I was fucking 11 years old. What did I do? Fuck that. I'm not going back there. I didn't want to go when I was 5. You know, of course, I have my father in the background rooting that all along. That Father O'Connor, he ain't nothing but a fucking drunk, you know. You all following that? And that's what I got from him. You know, he hated everything about it. He didn't go with the, you know, broken family. It was what we would call unequally yoked, right? Seriously. But as a kid, you know, there was a little bit of structure that came with my mother trying to give me God. And the people on her side of the family supporting the idea, right? My Italian cousins over there, my grandmother, her brother, they're all Catholics, right? But then on my father's side, there was my father, and there was his brother, my uncle. They were two peas in a pod. They were all this atheist slash Gnostic stuff. They hated, I mean, hated anything that had to do with church and religion, right? And, wow. How did I end up going up on this fucking jag? I don't know. But, you know, I, of course, found myself in that milieu questioning God, right? I had sort of kind of answers to it. I had like that kind of punishing Roman Catholic God, you know, you do this, you get punished for the book. It's wrong, but I had made some kind of sense out of it. And then I was like, you know what? I don't want to be punished no more. I don't want to live by these hard fucking rules, and I don't want to be slapped every time I fail. Fuck this crap, right? And I start questioning that. And but at the same time, it's really weird because, well, before I go down that road, you know, the questioning God of it. You know, once you question, well, I gotta go down that road now, because what I gotta say is, there's a little bit of duality, I think, that goes on in most everybody where we're questioning a God is concerned, because, like I was saying before, the world sucks. It's obvious. It's evident. You get heartbreak. You really need there to be some kind of repose, some kind of rest, some kind of rescue, a salvation. There has to be something good somewhere, and something helpful and something meaningful. And yet so often, you know, I mean, I think when we look to a church, we look to the Bible, we look to Jesus Christ, we look to God in general terms, we look to any kind of, that's what we're really looking for, right? Solace and sanctuary. But when we look at, like, the quote-unquote church, we're not finding that there. And the church is a fucked up thing, too. I mean, it depends. Like, I talked about being raised Roman Catholic. So you're Roman Catholic, you think of a church, you think of Roman Catholic Church, you know, St. fucking Peter and Paul and, you know, that city, whatever. And you got the Catholic priest in there who is celibate and maybe gay and whatever, you know, whatever's going on. But, you know, to a Catholic, the church is the Catholic Church. What's going on in the Vatican and Rome under the Pope and the hierarchy all the way down. But if you're Protestant, the church is something completely different than that, right? It's some form of Protestantism. And you have no regard for what Roman Catholic is. Why? That's what you protested. If you're Reformed Protestant, that's what you reformed from. You know, the Roman Catholicism was fucked up to you, so you went and made your own thing, changed it to be your own way. In the West, right, that is your Western Christianity right there. It's either Roman Catholicism or it's some form of Protestantism. The two of them have no regard for the orthodoxy that they're both split off of, right? The Romans directly are split from the orthodoxy, and then indirectly by being split from the Romans are the Protestants. And then the Protestants split 10,000 times over, right? And what you got is a divided church. And if you just look at, quote-unquote, the church in that regard, it's just everything that's fractured against its own self, divided and can't stand up, and you can't even make the first step in that direction. You just see the reality of what people do. And you hear it all the time. And I had all the arguments too, you know. Religion is what people do to faith. We fuck it up. That's what we do. We're looking for answers. I mean, who are you going to ask? All right, well, I'll get on my knees and I'll pray before God and I'll say, God, will you help me understand, you know? And he will. He will, but it won't be on your terms, and you'll miss the answer when it comes 99 times out of 100, right? It's how we are. So we look to other people. It's like when we were kids, right? I was talking about being young, and you learn the how of everything. You go and you parrot, right? In AA, we used to say fake it till you make it, and yeah, you're just really going along to get along and just figuring it all out on the way. So you're like a child again like that, and somewhere along the way you got to peel apart and start asking the why questions and getting all the answers. That's exactly how my life played out, you know, as it happened. But I questioned the church, and you know what? Because all of my other answers were questions. That's what I had with the church too. I questioned the church, and I answered them with other questions. Well, you know, hey church, what about God? Well, hold on, what about this church? Why are you all fucked up? You know, it would become my belief. The questions that I would ask about what was going on there would start to become my own answers, right? And I didn't know the church. I just had questions and doubts. And at the same time, I had that real pressing need for it. Somewhere under, you know, an undercurrent of my thinking was a desperation. Why would I be thinking and considering the church in the first place, right? Which is fucked up about atheists. Atheists are always arguing their points against God and Christianity, and specific, you know, very specifically Christianity. Why bother? Well, because there's a constant undercurrent of need, of necessity. We actually need Jesus Christ to be who he says he is. We need for this to be so. But when we look at the fucking churches, quote unquote churches, whatever and the variety of them they may be, whatever we perceive them to be, we look at these churches and we do not find that answer. We do not see that Jesus Christ there. We see these people fucking it all up. We do not get the solace that we're looking for in there. But we still need it. Our mind is fighting against our heart. We can't put it all together. It's a really sad circumstance, right? I, as a teenager, got to where I hated the fucking church. I fucking hated it. Now, that was fueled by personal experience. I didn't like going to catechism and shit when I was a kid. I did not like it at all. I always got in trouble. I always got kicked out. You know, I hated it. I fucking hated it. And the worst I hated it was like the most serious it ever was. We lived in Greenbrook and we went over to a Catholic church in the next town, Dunellen, right? I don't even remember what it was called. But the people that ran the CCD / catechism classes that they had there for us kids, and I was like third, fourth grade, right? There were nuns, and they were salty, you know, they were mean. I wasn't used to that. I didn't go to Catholic school. I didn't deal with nuns, but that's what they had there. That was, they had a Catholic school in that church. They did CCD after hours. Their teachers were nuns. The principal was like a higher nun. They were mean, crusty, old, salty women, right? And I did not get along with them. I did not get along with them at all. You know, and probably, but if I can remember being younger, I remember being in the kindergarten and in the first grade in Hillside, New Jersey, over there, down the street from my cousin's house, right? I used to go to the church over there, Christ the King. And we did our catechism classes. It might have been Sundays during church. It wasn't like after school or anything. It was different. And I hated it then. And being in church during the mass, couldn't stand it, you know. The best part of that was me and my brother fighting each other. I got my brother, you're younger than me. My mother would have to sit in the middle and we'd be over her lap throwing fucking punches. And for no reason. Just because boredom, right? Bored. But I hated it. I fucking hated it. And when I became a teenager, I started to hate it with reason. And I didn't quite get what the reason was, but I'm telling you what it is now. It's that difference between mind and heart. What I was gathering in my head and all these questions, these unanswered questions I had, coupled with the need deep down for the answers to be exactly what I knew them to be. That Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that he is the solace that I seek. I couldn't get through the people factor of it, and I couldn't make all this shit connect. And it just blew up as fiery fucking hatred inside of my system. I hated the church like you never hated the fucking church, right? And then, of course, I got my father in the background shoveling the fucking coals, right? Like the devil himself. But, I mean, I hated the church like I vandalized churches when I could, whenever I was in one or near one. I literally would piss on them. I would go up to the door. I'd go up to the door, and I'd whip my dick out, and I would piss right on the fucking church. If I happened on a Bible, I'd light it on fire. You know? If I was inside a church, I'd vandalize and steal. I'd break shit. I fucking hated it. And then anytime I would have a conversation with somebody about God and religion, I would always, always use my leverage, if I had any, to steer the person away from it. I fucking hated God. I hated Jesus. I hated priests. I hated Christians. I hated Christianity. And, you know, it's funny. I was always focused on that, but it was never a hatred for Judaism. It was never a hatred for Islam. It was never a hatred for Hinduism or Shintoism or, you know, it was always the Christ thing. And I recognize that. I may have mentioned it before, that atheists, they hate Christianity, but they don't have such a fiery disregard for all these other religions. The idea of atheism is that you're supposed to be non-spiritual. That's all that is. You don't believe in a spiritual world or an afterlife or anything like that. It's all the here and the now. It's the experience we have within the limits of our five senses and what we could do as human beings in the short time that we have. And then we die and that's the end of it. We rot in the ground and that's all. Right? And that's what atheism is. And if I believe that, why the fuck would I care about it? There's only one reason why I would care what everybody else thinks. Because what everybody else thinks is their beliefs, and their beliefs are the foundations of their ideas. And their ideas end up being impositions on society, right? That would bother me. But I don't have control over that. Anyway, that aside, still it's kind of funny how it's always about the Christians and never about the Muslims. It's always about the Christians and never about the Jews. You know, that's atheist thinking is always doing battle with Christianity. Ask yourself why. I'm going to leave you a question. You could question the question. Why? Why is that so? You answer that for yourself. I already got the answer, I'm pretty sure. Well, yeah, questioning God. Right? We get into this idea of questioning God, and then how do we do it? There's really two things that we can do once we start questioning God. And I was just talking about the atheism right there. That's erasing it, right? Just the whole idea of it, just, nah, it ain't so. It ain't so. Which is sort of kind of nihilistic, right? It's a, you're like taking a reality and pretending it ain't there, right? And that's how I look at it. Of course, you're going to argue with that because you're argumentative and rebellious and all that. But you just keep on trying. You keep coming. We'll get you right. The other thing you could do is just like step in that direction, but not quite the whole way there. That's where you deface God or redefine God. Or like I say, or like AA taught me, putting God on my terms. AA said you got to approach God on God's terms, right? That's what we said in AA. So the opposite of that is taking God and making him on my terms, which is what I found that I always did. See, when I was clean and sober, and I was beginning into a spiritual pursuit, and I was kicking the idea of a quote-unquote higher power, which turns out to be God with a capital G later on, around, I had to figure out exactly who God is and how to address God and how to get along God with God, right? How to communicate, how to pray, how to meditate, all this stuff. But before I met God on God's terms, it was always on my terms. I would always take what I knew of God and try to mix it up with what I knew otherwise. Right? It's the idea of like trying to shove God into a box with a shoehorn to make it fucking fit your way. And maybe it does, maybe it don't. If it does, well, you've got this convoluted kind of defaced slash redefined version of God, you know, your own version. And if it don't fit at all, well, you cast it aside and you play atheist for a little while, you know, or agnostic, just godless, because you can't have it your way. A little fucking baby brat can't have it your way. And it reminds me, like, back in my Antichrist motherfucker days. Probably at some of the darkest depths of them, to be honest with you. Now, you wouldn't get this. You wouldn't expect this. You listen to this podcast, and you got this cowboy guy down in Texas, and you got country music this, and Waylon Jennings, and George Strait that. And actually, you know, back in the day, I was a really big Nine Inch Nails fan, right? Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails. And, you know, he had some songs that were really so blatantly anti-God. You know, if you knew the lyrics, right? A Heresy, which was on The Downward Spiral. God is dead and no one cares. If there is a hell, I'll see you there. Right? Heresy, right? Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails. I remember like driving around Newark. I had a job shortly after that album came out. I think that was, what, 94? 96, I was working at a Piscataway for a commercial heating and air conditioning company as a parts manager. And I would spend half my days like humping parts around on these big commercial projects that we had. A lot of them were up in Newark, so I'd be like driving around Newark, going through the ghetto, and I'd have the windows up. I had the pickup truck, right? They gave me a pickup truck, a work truck that I drove, a big black pickup truck, and I wore black all the time, and I listened to Nine Inch Nails all day, every day, and I'd be pounding this shit, you know. God is dead. It's all like reverberating back off all these brick buildings through Newark and all these ghetto neighborhoods, and I was serious about it, you know. I was down with it. I was down with it. I understood the sentiment, you know. That one, there's quite a few songs, actually. Another one was Suck on that the EP. What the fuck was the EP called? I shouldn't remember. It was Broken, right? Just Broken. The second album. Nine Inch Nails did all this stuff. They had like all these varieties of releases that were like varieties of songs or like little collections. They had a couple of albums and one EP, right? But they would name them like Halo 1, Halo 2, Halo 3, you know, and maybe like the full album would be Halo 4, and then there would be an EP, it'd be like Halo 9. And these are not the exact numbers. I had everything like up to like Halo 14 or something like that. And then I was like Nine Inch Nails when Nine Inch Nails was Nine Inch Nails. I saw them. I saw them in 95. I saw Nine Inch Nails when Nine Inch Nails was still Nine Inch Nails, right? And then what happens? You know, guy gets older. We talked about maturity earlier, right? The guy gets older and starts to change. It's funny, you know, I bring up Nine Inch Nails. And I bring it up all the time because it matters to me. It's central to my existence, the fact of my faith, right? I'm Orthodox Christian. My priest, right? He's a Gen Xer, a little bit younger than me, but humongous Trent Reznor fan. To this day, he's got everything. He never stopped listening to Nine Inch Nails. You bring that up with him, you got yourself a three-hour conversation, right? He's gone through all the changes with Trent Reznor as he grew up, you know? I had heard that he had changed a lot. I had read something about his changes, but I dropped the music when I regarded his intensity has slid away. And it was shortly after the Downward Spiral, I think, like the next album or maybe the album after that. It didn't have that punch to me anymore. There was something happening with him, like getting sobered up, maybe finding faith. But until he did, he had some lyrics, very superior lyricist, the dude was. Real excellent musician, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, sadly, there was a lot of this anti-God sentiment. And on the Broken EP, which I regard, that was my favorite collection of stuff. It just was. It was a real heavy version of Nine Inch Nails. Nine Inch Nails was, for you way out there in future land, what was called an industrial rock band in the late 80s, early 90s, during the grunge era. But they weren't really grunge. They were what was called industrial, and industrial was like a real heavy I don't know how you'd really put it. It was heavy, but not heavy metal. It was dirty, but not punk. It had rhythm, but it was not hip-hop. It was digital, right? Very digital music, not analog. I see, when you think like heavy music, you really think analog, you know, like the old pedals and actual instruments and shit tuned down and, you know, but that was all, this was all, in fact, you know, it was digital because it was really a one-man band. When I say Nine Inch Nails / Trent Reznor, Trent Reznor is Nine Inch Nails. He did everything in studio by himself, by digital means, and played the instruments where he could, you know. And then he would have a touring band. They'd go out and they'd play, right? So shit about Nine Inch Nails that you didn't care. But you know, another song that was really, it was just a particular lyrics of a particular song that always struck with me and stuck with me. And if I talk about the, like, the idea of questioning God, doubting God, or not wanting God, God not fitting into my shoebox with my shoehorn, the songs suck, right? Talking about the world's supposed to what? Suck. Well, Trent Reznor had his song called Suck. And one line, there is no God up in the sky tonight. No sign of heaven anywhere in sight. Which again, to me, right? Reality as I know it to be, that is an avoidance of reality right there. That is nihilistic thinking, right? What I'm trying to say is, yeah, fucking A, yeah, there's a God. There absolutely is a God. And any kind of sentiment like this that's saying that, let's pretend there's not one, okay? Well, let's pretend. And it's nihilistic, and it's bullshit, right? But they are really good lyrics, and they do express exactly where the guy was at, you know? And I'm going to say, Nine Inch Nails was powerful, but you got to know how to listen to it. You got to know how to listen to it. You can't be sucked into the emotion of it. You got to look at it objectively. You know, you got to stand outside of it like a fly on the wall. You're an observer of the human condition. If you let yourself get sucked into it, you'll be killing yourself within a year. I swear, it's that heavy. It's really heavy. So anyway, yeah, Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor, industrial music. That's what it was called, right? Industrial rock. So nihilism, it's avoiding reality, an aversion to truth. Now let me hit you with some scripture right here, all right? There's a place in scripture where Jesus Christ separates himself from the rest of the pack, and the separation that results from these words, I tell you now, is the reason that atheists go after Christianity and leave the other religions alone. So listen up. This is serious shit right here. John chapter 14, starting at verse 6. And I'm just going to do this off the top of my head, okay? So I may or may not be exactly verbatim. But Jesus is answering a question of one of his apostles. That Jesus answered, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You have seen me, therefore you have seen the Father. And then it goes on from there, all right? These are the words that separate Christ as an entity, as a, let's call it a religious entity, from all of the rest. He is one with the Father. He is and amongst the Holy Trinity. He is God in the flesh. He is called Emmanuel, God with us. These are the things that we want Christ to be. This is the undercurrent that I was talking about earlier. that lives within us all. We are seeking the solace. We are seeking the sanctuary from this fucked up world and all the fucked up people. And we know it's fucked up world with fucked up people because we know how fucked up we are. Nihilism, it's avoiding reality. And it's avoiding truth. Because we just can't fucking take it anymore. So we pretend. We come up with utopian fantasies. We turn to narcotics and any other kind of diversion to avoid the reality. Because drugs are for people that can't handle reality. But if Jesus Christ is truth, that makes him the reality. And reality extends from him. So what if, here's a question for you, maybe a couple. What if nihilism is avoiding Jesus Christ? What if avoiding Christ is, like nihilism, a delusion within a mental disorder? Here's some truth bombs for all y'all. The world obviously sucks. Because of that, we formulate these fantasies of utopia. But I tell you that the world is supposed to suck. By these means, we learn that existence without God is a terrible thing. I want to remind you of a Black Sabbath song, and I don't know if I mentioned it earlier or not, or in another episode or not, from the Master of Reality. Interesting, right? Interesting. The Master of Reality LP back from the 70s, you know, when Black Sabbath was Black Sabbath with Ozzy Osbourne in it and everything, right? A song called Into the Void. Into the Void. It's basically a song by its lyrics speaking to the idea of fleeing this shitty earth and the shitty circumstances with the shitty people, getting the fuck out of here, literally the flying fuck out of here by rocket ship, without no promise, without no guarantee, without no assurance of what may be out there, but with the hope that out there is freedom. And that's the words that Ozzy wrote into the song. Freedom. We're in search of freedom. From what? This shitty, rotten fucking world. And all the reasons that the utopians in and amongst us utopianize. It is a great song. It is a great song. And ultimately, really, what it hearkens to is the experience of death and entering into eternity. To dying of this life and being taken from this earth and moving into your spiritual afterlife. It's really cool. It's a great song. Into the Void by Black Sabbath. Anyway, with that in mind, just put that a backdrop. But play the song and listen to what I'm telling you about right here, okay? Get that song in your head and listen to what's going on. More truth bombs. We have always, man, I know this about me, and I'm sure it is with you, deep down. We have always blamed God for the problems in this world. How could a good God, how can an all-powerful, all-knowing God allow for this to happen, and allow for that, and permit these things? God this, God that, why the fuck, you know, and all the questions that go with it. The questioning of God again, and the answers that we make up ourselves, and the decisions that we make to make our own God and our own understanding, which ultimately is us, ourselves as God. Yes, that's what we do. We make ourselves to be God by trying to fit God into the shoebox with the shoehorn like I was talking about. We have always blamed God for the problems. When in reality, when the truth is, that God is the solution to these problems. A God-fearing man like me does not find problem in this world. I have peace because I have God. And I have God because I have Jesus. Because Jesus separated himself from all other, quote-unquote, religious entities. He stands out in a crowd as something different, as something unique, and ultimately, in pursuit of him, you will find, as he says to you, truth! For he is the way, the truth, and the life. We've always blamed God for these problems when God is the solution. We live in the problem and we complain and complain. And we mock the solution. We mock God and we complain and we complain. And we are therefore just a bunch of little whiny bitches. Deep down in us all, we want Jesus Christ to be who he says he is. Because we need rescue. We need liberation. We need a savior. Jesus says, come to me, all of you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. He said that 2,000 years ago, and he says it today. Why? Because he's still alive. You can hear those words and you can accept those words as real and present. They are made for you, and you who are burdened and heavy laden will find your rest there. We want to believe that, but we cannot believe it because of his followers. People, fuck it up. People, fuck it up. We have a good thing. We have this treasure that we found in a field, and it is of great value. And we pick it up with our own two hands, and we fuck it up. The rest of us who come seeking, we go seeking for God. We go to people who think they know God, and they can't express God. They can't get the point across to you because they are people and they are fucked up. Because of that, we make the critical mistake of judging Jesus Christ by the troubled humanity about him. We wrongly equate the solution, who is Christ, who is God, with the problem, who is the people. Listen, man, listen to me. You know I'm a faithful person, but you also know that I am far from perfect. If you are going to judge the reality and truth and wonder and solace and sanctuary of Jesus Christ by my failings, you are going to miss out on your solutions, and you will always be living in the problem, and you will always be confused, thinking you have answers when all you got are the questions. Believe in the questions like I've always believed in the questions. And you believe in what? Nothing but making a fucking ruckus. The world obviously sucks. And there's no doubt about that. We all get a raw deal. Everybody's got their story. Everybody's got their circumstances. Park Avenue, park bench, it doesn't really fucking matter. We've all got problems. We all get the raw deal. We all need God. Deep down, we all want God. But people fuck it up. Sadly, I too am people. I fuck it up. J. Jesus Christ is for you to embrace directly. The relationship is personal, right? I am not an intercessory being. You do not gain Christ through me. You step up into the light and take on Christ personally. When you do that, you will know God. You will know peace. Everything changes. Right, right? That which is correct begins with the acceptance of God on God's terms. Not God on my terms, not God on your terms, God on God's terms. Where do we find God's terms? All we've got to go by is Holy Scripture. If you want to argue with me, if you want to deny what I'm saying to you, if you want to tear the pages of the Bible apart, paragraph by paragraph, and discount it, you do so to your own demise. That is fine by me. I am here to let it all be known. And those will accept. And those who do not will turn back into the darkness and take on all of the calamity and all of the failure and all of the dysfunction and all of the disorder and all of the chaos and all of the evil and all of the problems, the pain, the hurt, the ailments, every fucking bad thing that there ever is and ever was. Have it. Have it. But I'm telling you truth today. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. As I said, now, I found that I believed the questions when I needed answers. The answers are there, but people, in their self-centeredness, fail to find them. They must be found for oneself by careful and certain blessed discernment. Do you believe in the questions? You question everything till you start listening for answers. I am the rebel. I've always been the rebel. I was the most rebellious, literally voted most rebellious in my high school. They made a trophy for me for being rebellious. I know about rebellion. And you know what a real rebel knows about rebellion? That when you stake out and stalk down rebellion to its furthest extent, in the end, there is only rebellion left to rebel against. That was my experience in this life. And that's the experience of our culture now in general, as we are in 2023. Look around you. Christianity has become the alternative rather than the norm. Am I right? Christianity is not the standard. It is the alternate lifestyle. It is unpopular. Christianity has become the alternative rather than the norm. Tradition by that faith is now the cutting edge. Morality is the rebellion against the rebellion. The Christian is the dissident.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers. but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.